Okay, thanks. But before going into the discussion that everyone is waiting for, right? Is it a planet or is it not a planet? I would like to talk about a few scientific facts first, because the fact of being a planet or not a planet is not a scientific issue. It's essentially a semantic issue. So we can discuss for hours or days, everybody can have an opinion, and everybody's opinion is right, because it's not something you can prove. It's a semantic issue and not a scientific issue. So I will start with a few scientific issues to tell you why we are so excited in the planetary community about this object and why this object is so cool. So it's called Sedna. This name is not yet official. The official name is 2003VB12. It has been announced last Monday by the Discoverer team, led by Mike Brown at Caltech, and a big team which involved a lot of people, because in fact the object was discovered 1 year ago, and in order to get a good orbital determination, they had to go back looking at archive images of other surveys, in particular the NEAT survey led by David Rabinowitz at Yale, and they could have been able to track the objects back for a couple of years, which gives today a quite well-determined orbit. So it's an object discovered very far from us. It's discovered at 90 AU from the Earth, where AU is the astronomical unit, is the mean distance of the Earth from the Sun. So this object is currently 90 times more distant than we are from the Sun. But it's very bright. I mean, it's very faint because it's very far, but it's intrinsically very bright, which argues that the object is big. How big it is, we don't know, because to measure the diameter, the size of a planet or a body, you need to have it to observe it in the infrared. And all attempts to observe these objects in the infrared have failed. It's too faint to be seen in infrared. So this says that the diameter of this object is less than 1,500 kilometers. On the other hand, it cannot be much smaller than 1,500 kilometers, because otherwise we would not see it in the visible wavelength either. So assuming that this object has the same albedo as Pluto, which is the albedo is the reflectance power, so the fraction of this light that the object receives from the Sun and reflects it into space. Pluto has a very high albedo of 30%. Assuming that this object has the same albedo of 30%, it turns out that its size in diameter is 1,200 kilometers, which is about half of the Pluto size, because Pluto is 2,300 kilometers in size. So it's half Pluto, it's the biggest object we know in the distant solar system apart Pluto. And this raises the question, is it a planet or not? Which we'll address at the end. But what is really surprising and exciting about this object is its orbit. It's a very elliptic orbit. You know, every object goes around the Sun on an ellipse, but this is a very elliptic orbit. It comes, the closest point to the Sun, which is called the perihelion, is at 76 astronomical units from the Sun, so 76 times the distance from the Earth. The Sun major axis is about 500 AU, and so at its maximal distance from the Sun, this object goes to 1,000 AU, 1,000 times more distant than the Earth. It's really a very surprising object, in particular for a body that big. So, and to make you understand why this orbit is so peculiar and so interesting, I have prepared one plot, the only plot allowed in a board talk. So this diagram shows, I could have drawn it on the board, it would have been a mess and no one would have understood. So this diagram shows the perihelion distance and the aphelion distance of a bunch of bodies that will appear. As I said, the perihelion distance is the closest distance to the Sun that the body reaches along its orbit, and the aphelion distance is the most distant point from the Sun that the body reaches around its orbit. So there is a line here, which is a line perihelion equal to aphelion. Circular orbits are here, and nothing is here because the aphelion must be bigger than the perihelion. So we have four planets, four real giant planets, which are Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune.
Why would you put them in another galaxy?
Why?
It's the log of Q. They're all the way over on the other side of the universe.
Okay.
Very good. You're stretching things.
Yeah, well, okay, sure. I mean, these are Q and Q, okay. In a log scale. Okay. Thanks. Okay, so Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, they have orbits which are essentially circular, And this was all we knew, right, until 1930, when in 1930 a new object, yes, wait a second, okay, a new object appeared, Pluto. So 1930, Pluto was discovered. And as you see, its orbit is a little bit atypical because it's not on this line of circular orbits. Its aphelion distance is bigger than the perihelion distance. And in fact, so this orbit is moderately eccentric. And in fact, the orbit of Pluto intersects the orbit of Neptune. This doesn't mean that Pluto can crash on Neptune because its orbit is a peculiar orbit. It has a period which is an integer ratio with the period of Neptune. So every time Pluto crosses the orbit of Neptune, Neptune is on the other side of the orbit, so the two planets never encounter each other, and so this is a dynamically stable configuration. So 1930, we have our ninth planet. In 1950, there is another population which appears, the Oort cloud population. I mean, the number of comets observed on long-period orbits became big enough that the Dutch astronomer Oort understood that the comets must come from a very distant region, which is here. So these are very elliptic orbits whose aphelion is at about from 20,000 to 40, 50,000 astronomical units from the Sun. And we see the objects which are here, so very big aphelion and very small perihelion. But a few considerations made Oort conclude that, in fact, this region was big and must have contained also objects with much larger perihelion distance that we don't see, but they must exist in order to produce the comets that we do see. So in 1950, we are left with this image, planets here, Oort cloud over there, and a huge gap in between. Okay. It took 42 years from 1950 in order to start to fill the gap. 1992, another object was discovered. It's called 1992 QB1. And as you see, its position is here, not very far from Pluto. And immediately afterwards, a large number of objects from similar orbits have been discovered. And these objects were not unexpected by the astronomers. In fact, simple reasoning that the solar system could not end brutally with a big planet, but there must have been something else, made people suggest that there was at least there should have been at least a population of small bodies beyond Neptune. So this was the conjecture made by Kuiper, by Edgeworth, and others. And this is why we call these objects today the Kuiper belt. Okay, so nice discovery, very interesting for planetary science, but not totally unexpected. But there is still a big gap going from the 50 AU that at most Kuiper belt objects travel to the Oort cloud, which is at 20,000 AU in aphelion distance.
Putting in the Oort cloud at a time when it was theorized, and the Kuiper belt at a time when
discovered
in situ, and nothing's been seen up in that part of the plot yet.
Of course, we don't have any direct observation. Well, we do have direct observation of Oort cloud objects down here, so small perihelion distance and large aphelion. Okay, and the rest is simply deduced by consideration. But it's something, I mean, among all theories, it's a really long living one. It was proposed in 1950. It has never been challenged. And this is really a great result. It doesn't happen often that something proposed in 1950 is not challenged up to now. So it's almost an observational fact, I would say. Okay, so another big step forward to understand the distant solar system, it happened in 1996 with the discovery of another object, 1996 TL66. And this object is peculiar because, you see, we are going farther out. So it's an object which is much more elliptic than the others. Its perihelion is around 35 astronomical units, and its aphelion is above 100. And in particular, its dynamic is different with respect to Pluto and the Kuiper belt objects. While Pluto and the Kuiper belt objects do not encounter Neptune, even when they are on a Neptune-crossing orbit because of this integer ratio of orbital periods, this guy does encounter Neptune. So it has close approaches with Neptune, which gives kicks to the velocity of the object, like the kicks that we use in order to send space probes through the solar system and saving fuel. So this object is here now, but has not always been here. And every time it approaches Neptune, it gets a kick and it moves. It moves more or less vertically, keeping constant its perihelion distance, because given that it is Neptune which gives the kick, it must go back to Neptune. And the aphelion can travel along along various distances. And in fact, since 1996, we have discovered many brothers of this object, which is what we call today the scattered disk. And as the Kuiper belt, the scattered disk was also expected by the astronomers. Yeah, bright. Because, you know, the planets must have formed in a planetesimal disk. And there is no such a planetesimal disk now. That means that after the planets formed it, they got rid of it. And the way they get rid of the planetesimal disk is by scattering. They, by gravitational scattering, they send the planetesimals all over the place. And many of the planetesimals scattered by Neptune must have gone in these directions. And numerical calculations by Duncan and Levison show that of all the bodies that Neptune originally scattered in this direction, about 1% are still alive today. So the scattered disk objects are the real, the true leftover of planetary accretions. These are the planetesimals Neptune formed from. Okay, so these are very important, and we know now a good fraction of them. The current mass, the current estimate of the mass of the scattered disk now is a tenth of an Earth mass, equivalent to the total mass of the Kuiper belt. And so remembering that these are just 1% of the planetesimals initially scattered by Neptune in this direction, it means that initially about 10 Earth masses had to go in this direction from Neptune. These are all observed in the optical and even sometimes in the infrared. Reflected light. And in fact, this direction that I'm keeping pointing at, we can call it the Oort cloud highway, because this is the way that the objects have to take and have been taken for 4.5 billion years in order to build and then refill the Oort cloud. So this is the way objects go, have gone and formed and keep going to the Oort cloud. Okay. So this is...
Many of them actually go through Jupiter and then go...
Yeah, okay. We'll talk about that later. And, okay, so okay. So this is the picture we had after, soon after 1996. And this picture seemed fairly consistent with our understanding, with a few details for the Kuiper belt, which are mysterious. But then problems... Yes?
Sorry, the Kuiper belt has still many objects. You say none of them encounter Neptune.
Yes.
Do they sort of stay together? Is it a clump or is it spread out over?
No, it's a big, big annulus. Okay.
No, they're all in this. None of them encounter.
It's a big annulus, so the bodies which are not very eccentric don't intersect the orbit of Neptune. And the bodies that do intersect the orbit of Neptune are protected because they have an orbital period which is an integer ratio with Neptune. And so when they cross the orbit of Neptune, Neptune is away, like Pluto.
The dump is kind of like the asteroid.
Like the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. Okay. And the scattered disk objects, on the contrary, are scattered. Okay. So this is a sort, if you want, a static population, and this is a dynamically evolving population. So this figure looked nice, and things started to mess up in 2000. In 2000, an object, which is called 1995 TL8, got its orbital determination done well. I mean, the objects have a date of discovery, but when you discover the object, you don't know the orbit. So the real date when the bodies become important is when the orbit is well determined. So it's only in 2000 that the orbit of 1995 TL8 has been constrained. And this object, as you see, is very close to the Oort-Clyde highway, but not really. It's off the edge. So I got, at the time, very intrigued by this object. I said, well, I mean, there's something weird going on. Everybody said, no, don't worry about it. It's just the orbital determination is not very accurate, and maybe the planets shake a little bit, there is migration, and so on. And so you shouldn't worry about this object. And maybe it's true. It's fairly easy. It's so close to the Oort-Clyde highway that any kind of perturbation could have put that object there. But in 2001, another object came out, 2000 CR 105. And this one is farther out and more distant from the Oort-Clyde highway. Its perihelion distance is 44.5 astronomical units, whereas the Oort-Clyde highway reaches 38, 40 astronomical units at most. And
the vertical dashed line, a theoretical line, or did you just fit what you had up to line?
No, this is a sort of theoretical lines. I mean, it's a drawing, okay, but it comes from numerical simulations that where the bodies, you put particles in the scattered disk, you let them evolve, and you look at what is the boundary. Of course, it's a sort of fractal structure, but here I had to do a drawing. But CR105 is well off, okay. And people started to really think seriously about the origin of this object, I mean, the origin of the orbit of this object, because Well, this is a very elliptic object, orbit, and all the bodies must have been formed on circular orbits. So this object formed somewhere, we don't know if here, 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 or here, but something, some mechanism must have placed it there. And we have to find that mechanism, which has been debated quite a while in the literature. And as people were debating, here comes the new discovery, which is really amazing. So this is Sedna. So Sedna is even more extreme, much more extreme than 2000 CR 105. As I said, its perihelion distance is way, way off the Oort-Clyde highway. It's 75 astronomical units, and its aphelion distance is almost 1,000 astronomical units. So evidently, something happened in the solar system that could emplace objects here, and that we need to figure out. Okay. Now, Sedna is also important because it's so big. Also, 2000 CR 105 is big. It's 300 kilometers, but this one is a monster. As I said, 1,200 kilometers. And big objects are rare. So if you see them on odd orbits, it means that these orbits are not that odd. So we expect many other objects, maybe smaller, on the same kind of orbits. Right? Okay, so what happened in the solar system that could have made this mess? Well, the key point to keep it on count is that as a body, the farther out is the body in a diagram like that, the more difficult it is to observe. Because we observe bodies only when they pass close to the sun, because it's where they are bright enough. So if a body, say, with a fixed perihelion has an aphelion which is farther and farther, it means that its orbital period becomes longer, and the fraction of the time of its orbital period that it passes close to the sun becomes shorter and shorter. So it's much easier to find an object for a given perihelion distance. It's much easier to find an object if the aphelion is not far away than an object whose aphelion is very far away. And so the fact that the bodies with the most extreme perihelion distances have large aphelia of 400 to 1,000 AU immediately indicates that at least there is an overabundance of bodies here rather than here. We have discovered nothing with a perihelion like that of 2000 CR105 or even Sedna with smaller aphelion distance. So maybe there are some, but certainly they are outnumbered by the bodies with large aphelion distance. And this is what we have to keep in mind when we have to think about the origin of these objects. So what could be the origin of these objects? There are three easy ideas that come to the mind of people, right? There may be a 10th planet, a real planet, a famous planet X, somewhere there, which produces its own Oort-Clyde highway. And so we would have, then, if there is a planet there, we can expect bodies all over its Oort-Clyde highway, which may pass through 2000 CR 105 and Sedna. Why not? Well, planet X is tough, because people searching for Kuiper Belt objects and scattered disk objects and other odd objects have really scanned almost the entire sky around the ecliptic. The ecliptic is the band where the sun moves and the planet moves. And so it's difficult that they could have missed a planet, right? But it's true that observers jump over the galactic plane, because the galactic plane is so crowded with stars that it's crazy to go looking for a moving object there. So the surveys, like the one led by Mike Brown, has in fact explored a band around the ecliptic line of plus or minus 5 degrees with a hole in correspondence of the galactic plane. And so if the planet turns out to be there, it would not be discovered yet.
How long can it be there?
Depends on its orbital period.
But if it's out there,
for when, basically?
What?
For as long as the observation.
Yeah, I mean, observations, serious observations exist only since 10 years ago. So you have to wait.
And the normal period's like 300 years. 300 years.
Yeah. But this, if planet X were the origin of this object, this would not be the distribution that we observe. Because you see, Neptune has its own population of scattered disk objects. They are all the way from Neptune to the Oort cloud. But where do we see them? Here. Because it's much easier to see them, again, when their aphelion distance is small than when it is big. So if here there were a planet X with its own Oort-Clyde highway producing a population like that, we would discover these objects down here, not up there. Okay, so it's not planet X. The other possibility is that in the scattered disk, They are not just small bodies, but there are big bodies as well. Maybe some big body like Mars-sized object or even Earth-sized object. And what do? Well, they would act like a sort of Bigfoot traveling as a crazy through the highway and kicking everybody off the highway. And why not? But again, this would tend to give a distribution of bodies down here rather than up there, because it's much easier to encounter the others on the highway at perihelion, because all the bodies have come together in a narrow space, than at aphelion, where all the bodies are spread all over. So the bodies kicked off by a massive object in the scatter disk would preferentially be in this region and not in that region. So if we really have, and I think we can say we really have, because we have two objects now, an overabundance of bodies with large perihelia only for large aphelion distances, this tells us that the perturbation which emplaced the objects on these orbits came from the outside and not from the inside. And if you want a perturbation from the outside, well, the best candidate is a passing star. And in fact, you can do simulations, it's pretty easy. And for instance, a star which passes at 800 AU from the sun, solar mass star passing at 800 AU from the sun, is capable of kicking off the scatter disk bodies which are above this line only, and not perturbing significantly the objects which are below this line. So this can explain why we have these bodies here and we have nothing down here. Okay. But the story is not finished. Exactly. So the story is not finished here, because how many bodies are here? This paper by Mike Brown, so the discoverer of Sedna, makes some back on the envelope calculations based on one discovery, of course, because this is what they got. But Sedna, as I said, is 1,200 kilometers. And it has been observed at magnitude 20.5 in a survey which is limited at magnitude 21. So they've been that close to miss it. And that means that Sedna can be observed by Mike Brown only on 1/100, 1% of its orbit. So statistically, if they got one, there are 100. Okay. In addition, Brown et al. only surveyed the band of plus or minus 5 degrees from the ecliptic. And these bodies have a pretty large inclination. 2000 CR 105 is 23 degrees and Sedna is 12 degrees. So they go well off the band. They search. So, well, then it depends on their inclination distribution. Assuming an isotropic distribution, which is debatable, there should be 5 times more objects all over the sky than in the plus or minus 5 degrees band. And that's where Mike Brown gets this number that there should be 500 Sednas sitting there. Okay. And this can be debated, maybe just a couple of hundred.
Can we use that argument to argue there's 500 Italians in this room?
There are two, at least. I know there are two. Okay, so what was I saying? You perturbed me. Okay, then Sedna is huge, right? And the bodies have a size distribution. We see size distribution in the asteroid belt, as we see size distribution in the Kuiper belt, in the scatter disk. So assuming the same size distribution we see in the Kuiper belt, if there is a body of 1,500 kilometers there, there may be many more bodies smaller. And integrating over the size distribution, Mike Brown concludes that the population of objects here is about 5 Earth masses. Okay. It's a huge mass. Now, as I said, this can be debated because, well, we have discovered one object. Maybe Mike Brown is very lucky. He should try to gamble sometime to measure how lucky he is. So maybe it's not really 100 Sednas that there are on the same orbits. I don't think that their inclination distribution is isotropic, so you don't have to multiply by a factor of 5, but just a factor of 2. And then it may be possible that the size distribution is shallower than what is assumed, because already in the scatter disk, we seem to see a shallower size distribution. So this is a very uncertain estimate. Could be 5 Earth masses, could be maybe 10 times smaller. And we don't really know until more objects are discovered. But this sets a problem because, okay, the passing star takes the bodies from the scatter disk and lifts their perihelia. But as I said, at the beginning, through all the scatter disk, there were something like 10 Earth masses of objects. So for the star to decouple 5 Earth masses of objects, to put 5 Earth masses of objects here, you need to have had at least 5 Earth masses of objects here, above the line in the scatter disk. At any given time, you on the simulation of the scatter disk formation, you have such a mass up there. So if these are really five Earth masses, we have a problem. If these are 0.5 Earth masses, we can be good. But if these are five Earth masses, we have to think about something else. And there's all theoreticians when don't stop against anything. So we have to realize that the Oort cloud highway is not a one-way, one-lane highway. It is a four-lane highway. And in fact, we do see a few other objects on the other lanes. And this is not an American highway, you know, where the objects travel in the lanes more or less at the same speed. This is a European highway, where slow objects travel on the Neptune lane and the Uranus lane. Fast objects travel on the Saturn lane, and the Germans take the the Jupiter lane. And overspeeding is not a big issue, but right passing is strictly forbidden. So these bodies go much faster than all the others. And
but in England, they
do
the other way around.
Oh yeah. But I was talking about Europe, not about islands offshore United States. Sorry, Gordon. Okay, so the situation is different because here we have a given mass of bodies and they go out slowly. So they come into this region in a very diluted way. They go up on time scales of tens of millions of years. So the bodies that come here come in very diluted way, and at any given time there are not many of them. Here we have much more material because of the initial size distribution, the initial surface density distribution of the planetesimals. And the objects go away much faster in sort of 100,000 years or so, a few hundred thousand years. So if a star passes early, about 100,000 years, it will find much bigger crowd of objects here than it can find here at any given time. And in fact, if you really do have five Earth masses of material here, the only way to do it with a star is to decouple the objects here. And this sets constraints on the time scale of the stellar passage. So if these bodies are not many, then there could be bodies from the Neptune lane decoupled from the star, and therefore there is the star has time to come of several, a few 10 to the 7 years. Okay. If the total mass is less than five, much less than five Earth masses. But if the total mass is really of order of five Earth masses, the only way, we can take this away. I finished with my plot. The only way to do it is that the star decouples the objects from the Jupiter lane. And in this case, it has to come 100 times earlier, at about 10 to the 5 years or so. Is this reasonable, or is this crazy?
Sorry, can I ask, is it actually true that in the Neptune lane they're going up and not down?
They go up and down. They keep going up and down.
Is the average actually coming down?
Of all the objects that ever go into the scatter disk, most of them go down, and they escape by going here and being kicked away. Okay, that's why Neptune will migrate outwards. Huh? Yes, it's true. Yes, it's true.
50% plus or minus 50%.
No, it depends where you start to count them. If you start to count them when they start to travel out, they go in. And if you start to count them here, then it's different. Okay, well,
it's common. Could you say a word about when you talk about theory?
Yeah.
What do you actually mean?
And what is Don's question?
It's different than string theory.
I mean, it's different than string theory, definitely, because here we have a model which no one discusses about. It's Newton gravitational law. Okay. And then it's all based on either analytic estimates or more often numerical simulations. And we can argue about some aspects, like, for instance, were the planets always there? Did they move? Did they migrate? Did you take into account collisions? Did you take into account gas drag? Did you take into account? Okay. But essentially, it's more of the order of details. So when I'm saying that of the bodies here that go and here, 1% at the beginning of the solar system, 1% survives now, it's a fairly good estimate. And there is not much you can do to change it by orders of magnitude, in fact. And the same when I'm talking about time scales, bodies here take 100,000 years to go away. It's also something you can easily compute analytically, and you can easily check numerically. So this, I think, are... it's settled on a quite solid ground, even if it's still theoretical in the sense that you'd never see an object going away for 100,000 years. So, okay, is it crazy or not to assume that a star passed at about 800 AU from the sun in either 10 to the 7 years or 10 to the 5 years? So let's see what happens now. Luckily now, thanks to the Hipparchos mission, we have a very good measure of the stellar environment of the sun now and the radial and the velocities of the stars. So we know that we have in our environment about 160 stars in a sphere of 10 parsec of radius. Okay, and the parsec is about 200,000 astronomical units, so it's 10 times bigger than the Oort cloud. Okay? And with the current star population, we have statistically one encounter at something like 900 AU over 4.5 billion years. Okay.
That's statistical.
I mean, Hipparchos monitored.
Just isotropic gradients.
Well, no, it's done differently. Hipparchos has measured the position and the velocities of the stars within a given distance from the sun. And we can from that, one can compute all close approaches in the past 2 million years and in the future 2 million years. This is observation. Okay. And of course, nothing comes very close to the sun. And then by extrapolating with an R-square law, one gets that the closest object that comes, the object that comes closest to the sun with a probability of 1 over the age of the solar system, statistically, passes at 900 AU. So statistically, the sun in the current environment would have a close encounter with a star at 900 AU over the age of the solar system. Okay, but the sun now is in a quite quiet environment. We are in a quiet place in the galaxy, close to an arm, but not really in an arm. And observations that have been done on the formation of the stars show that the overwhelming majorities of stars, if not all of them, form in clusters. So when stars form, their environment is much denser. So we can try to understand what is the environment that we needed in order to have this kind of encounter timescales. And this is essentially in first order. There are many other things you can take into account, but the first order is the ratio of the timescales. So if you want an encounter in 10 to the 7 years instead of 4.5, 10 to the 9 years, you need to increase the the first 10 to the 7. So the idea that astronomers have is that stars form in clusters, and then the clusters disperse. Okay, so you have a lot of chances to get encounters very early, and then the cluster disperses and becomes much more rare to have an encounter. So if statistically you want an encounter in 10 million years, you have to increase the current star density by a factor of 400. Okay, and if you do that, a factor of 400, it means, let's go on the other side, it means about 20 stars per parsec cube. Okay. But if you want to have an encounter statistically in 10 to the 5 years, you have to multiply it by 40,000. And this gives you about 2,000 stars per parsec cube. So much bigger. So this is, as I said, 400 times current. And this is 40,000 times current. How do these numbers compare with what we observe in the sky? So, well, this is a quite normal number. I mean, open clusters have easily densities of this kind. The Hyatt cluster, which is a very loose dispersed cluster, has 3 stars per parsec cube. But in the Trapezium region, it's 100. And the most dense open cluster we know, which is M11, it's 500 stars per parsec cube. So these numbers are very reasonable. If you have to go to these numbers, we have a problem. 2,000 stars per parsec cube is much denser than the most dense stellar region that we know, except globular clusters, of course, but the sun did not form in a globular cluster, presumably.
500, factor 4?
Well, 500 is for the master of all open clusters, M11. So typically, you don't see 500. Trapezium is just 100. Orion is about the same number. So
even that's probably more stars.
Yeah, maybe. I would say that if if future observations saw that there is really a crowd here, so that we need to have a very early encounter, so to decouple the bodies from Jupiter, from the Jupiter lane, and then we have to go towards this kind of environment, most likely the Sun was in a binary, was a binary star.
But this is also a probability of one.
Right? Most so likely the Sun was a
sure.
star.
Wait, probability of one.
A second.
Right?
Yeah.
So if it's probability of 1/100, that would mean, you know, that's not.
Yeah, of course, of course. What we see could be the result of a very unlucky event that just happened. You can always have this. This solution one, yeah.
Well, I don't see what the problem is, because at 2000, then your time scale is still with 5 years, right?
Mm.
And that's much, much shorter than the ages of the clusters you mentioned, the densities of. I mean, 10 to the 5 years, you're talking about very dense cores that
can't tell
the density.
Yeah.
But you have a problem, because if you're an overdense star, you would have two such encounters. And if you have two such encounters,
I can turn the argument. I can turn the argument around, because you know, the Kuiper belt is truncated at 50 AU, as you see here, and people are debating on what caused this edge. And one of the theories is that another stellar encounter, much deeper, because truncated disk at 50 AU must have an encounter at 150 AU or so. So if you think that Jupiter forms in a million years, okay. And then when Jupiter forms in 10 to the 5 years, there is a star passing where you want. You can argue what is at which distance the other stars passed during the million year Jupiter was forming. And it's 200 AU. So you could have both the edge, this truncating encounter.
How many years that the Sun was in the cluster?
Well, then it gets dispersed. And I don't know.
No, the problem with the 10 to the 5 year having so much richer environment is it's not at 10 to the 5 years, as you're saying. It's at 10 to the 6th years. So then if you're getting encounters like
that. Yeah, let me qualify on that, because I've seen people puzzled. 10 to the 5 is equal to 10 to the 6. Even physicists don't do that. But the time here is counted from the moment when the planets start to send the materials off the highway lanes, okay? And you need to form the planet first, otherwise there is no scatterer. And to form the planet, you need time. So typically for Jupiter, we believe, and this is theory, that is really theory, not solid. Jupiter takes a order of million years to form, and then it starts very quickly to send particles of the lane. So we want a star hit the Sun in the first 10 to the 5 years after the formation of Jupiter, which takes 10 to the 6 years. So that's Jack Comet, okay?
But if you're going to get one in the first 10 to the 5 years, after those 10 to the 6 years,
yeah,
your characteristic loss time is presumably going to be at least 10 to the 6th years, because the cluster has been around for that long. So that means you're going to get another
repeated encounters, yeah. Repeated encounters in the beginning.
Unless the Sun was ejected.
Gives the Sun enough to get out of the cluster.
Yeah, you could eject the Sun at some point. And also, yes.
In 10 to the 5 years, Jupiter is likely to scatter most of the objects away from its environment. So 10 to the 5 years is a time scale that takes Jupiter to scatter everything from its environment outside the solar system.
Right.
So if it's right, but if you had an encounter every 10 to the 5 years, that's exactly fine, because the next one will come in the same empty system.
That's it.
Two times.
Sure, but not for the other ones.
But another encounter would get rid of the objects you create.
No, not really. You could, in fact, randomize the population. It will be interesting to have the inclination distribution of this object. It could become a well-randomized distribution, and you don't still have the problems of forming the Oort cloud, because then the Oort cloud is formed by the object in Neptune's lane, which come 10 million years afterwards. So there are no problems.
I think there's a more serious problem with those numbers, although it's somewhat unrelated, because you can just increase them. You're saying 400 times the current
environment.
Stellar density,
yes, yes,
gives you 400 times the current rate. And I don't believe that.
No, okay, I said that. So if you want the real formula, it's written here. So you have to take into account the focusing, gravitational focusing, because there is a big difference, because in a cluster, the typical velocity is 1 km/s, and now it's 30 km/s. Now it's 30 km/s. So there is a factor, okay, big difference in the fact. And also, when I say there is an encounter here, it's not a solar mass star. It's typically,
800 AU, the velocity around the sun is a kilometer per second. There is no focusing.
There is no focusing, but there's a flux difference.
Now there is no focusing.
Which is a factor of 30, which is what I'm concerned about.
Yeah, yeah.
The velocity of the Earth is 30 kilometers per second at 1 AU. At 800 AU, it's divided by square root of 800.
Yeah, I know. Here it's 1.5 kilometers per second.
Right. At so this, okay.
Now the stars fly by the sun at 30 kilometers per second. There is no focusing. Okay. Initially, in a cluster, the typical dispersion velocity you observe is 1 kilometer per second. So there is a focusing minor focusing factor, which is about 3. Okay. So there is a focusing factor of about 3, but you have to take into account that what Hipparchos shows is that one encounter at 900 AU in the age of the solar system, but it's not a solar mass star. It's typically smaller, like a fifth on a solar mass star. Then you have to plug in a mass distribution function for stars in clusters. Okay, and you can find whatever in the literature. And the best I found was an exponent of minus 1 cumulative. So the factor of 3 that comes by the focusing factor erases the factor of 3 or 5 that comes from the mass distribution of the stars. And the bottom line is that it comes down to the ratio of time scales. That was it. So I'm hiding most of the formula.
And 60, and that you're saying is the small stars or the
so according to Hipparchos, we have statistically one in current environment, one encounter in 900 AU over the age of the solar system with a star which is about a fifth on a solar mass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
More do you need to screw up the stability of the giant planet?
Oh no, the giant planet don't have any problem. Even if you have a solar mass star passing at 200 AU, they don't suffer.
Really?
Yes. Yeah, by simulations, yeah. And in Neptune can get a little bit excited, but it's damped immediately by all the objects that become Neptune crosser. And it's not a problem. Down to 200 AU, it's not a problem. Closer, it's more severe.
It's n sub v.
Yeah.
And the v is a factor of 30 different.
It's n sigma v, but v is a kind of 30 different. So, yeah. So that makes... That's true. I forgot the factor of 30. I have to say, well, it must be a way to absorb it. I mean, typically, these encounters are at about 100,000 AU in what did I say, 10 million years, are obtained by people in simulations like Fernandez and Brunini with something like 20 to 30, 35 stars per parsec cube. This is the bottom line. Take into account everything.
Okay, so velocity, size distribution. Why is the velocity dispersion doesn't matter as long as you don't have gravitational focusing? Because if the velocity dispersion is lower, then counter takes a longer time, and that makes a bigger effect. And if you assume that the interactions are only tidal interactions, meaning that the passing star still passes far enough from the system, then the velocity exactly cancels. What you get is that the passing star formula, on the average, gives you the same thing as stationary disks of stars. This is why in the galaxy, the passing stars and the galactic tides are just the same to an order of magnitude. And it's independent of the velocity dispersion. So maybe this
makes sense.
If the calculation that says it needs to be at 900 AU is for 30 kilometers per second, and you can get by with a much more distant encounter if you're going at 1 kilometer a second, then that's true. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the bottom line is that simulations done by Fernandez and Brunini in open clusters that live a few 10 million years show that if you have something like 30 stars per parsec cube, you get encounters at 1,000.
Okay, Moby, if you are referring to the simulations of Fernandez, these are tidal interactions, and it's according to this calculation.
Okay.
So that's the velocity
cancels. So if you want it 100 times faster, you multiply by 100.
In terms of the magnitude of the perturbation, not in terms of the distance of the encounter, which is what's being quoted here.
No, but we know which kind of encounter we want. We want a solar mass star on a parabolic orbit passing at 900 AU.
Parabolic orbit. Okay, then you have this. Are these moved, adjusted for the fact that the orbits aren't parabolic?
Which one?
The current flux rate at 900 AU, because those are not at all parabolic.
No, these are not parabolic. Yeah.
but it is really one counter at 900
yes,
AU,
yes.
Then the problem still exists.
Okay, I don't know about the parabolic orbit, because which just decided there shouldn't be much focusing.
If you do it
without parabolic orbit, just passing stars in straight lines, you try to touch the last stars, shouldn't be the case.
Anyway, we get the point. Yeah. The cluster stayed at all. I mean, you've smeared out this cluster over some enormous volume space.
Sure.
There's no way to trace it back.
No. But Hipparchos is not telling you what was the cluster of the sun. Hipparchos is just telling the encounter frequency now.
I don't know.
And then I was trying to do blackboard calculations on which kind of environment we need to have the encounters that we need. The bottom line is that having an encounter, parabolic encounter, at 900 AU in a order of 10 million years, you can do it in a normal cluster, not even a very dense one. But if you want the encounter happen at 10 to the 5 years, you need a monster. Okay. And if you need a monster, probably you cannot do it. But it's true also that the sun could have formed as a binary star, a loose binary star, the one of these binary stars that gets stripped in a few orbits.
Right.
And then the star is there. Okay. So and then that gets separated after a few orbits because of the environment of the cluster. This happens very, very often, in fact.
How do we know that it happened?
from observations, I think people count the look at the stars and where they are and how many binaries they are and what is their binding energy and what is the frequency of binary stars later on. And there are ways to compute these things. There are ways to compute these things. So if it was in a binary star, I mean, imagine a star with a perihelion of 1,000 AU and an aphelion of 50,000 AU, then okay, that's what did the job, and there is no statistic there. It's deterministic. The star was there.
But that is that you get repeated perihelion of the star. So doesn't that violate the criteria that only happened once?
No. I didn't say anything. We just have it
the
once.
The multiple passage will clear out the one.
Well, I mean, the passage then smear the population all over, no? But that could be good. That you could just have a sort of isotropic population, like in the Oort cloud, but much closer in, and due to multiple passages. In fact, the conclusion of all of this is that we don't know, right? Because we are just counting on one object. We have no clue what is the inclination distribution. It is isotropic or disk-like. We have no clue of how much mass is there. Okay. So I was trying to draw lines to say that in the future, when we will know more about these objects, their distribution, isotropic or disk-like, and their total mass, we will probably be able to infer about the environment in which the sun formed. Okay, multiple encounters, one encounters, and binary stars, cluster, which kind of cluster, we will be able to do it.
Well, you're because drawing we are a very strong conclusion that it has to be external.
Oh, yes, yes.
Right?
I'm ready to bet.
You're ready to bet.
Yes. Yeah, I'm ready to bet. I mean, two objects. I already did this discussion with one object, but very good at doing discussion with one object. But two objects with such extreme perihelion and such big aphelion, taking into account how the observational biases drop moving the aphelion up,
okay, I want to know
makes no sense.
Yeah.
The next planetary conference here. In 10 years, you have many more objects here than you not have here.
A case of Chianti or what?
Okay. Well, after a case of Chianti.
What's the experiment of observational survey?
It's very difficult because, yes, this is another point I was saying. So I would be much more comfortable in saying that there are not fiber masses of material here, but 10 times less would make problems much easier. And in fact, if you assume that there are all the bodies that Mike Brown estimates, you would expect that already 20 objects have been discovered here by the other surveys that discovered objects down there. Now, the question is that it's not clear how sensitive people are to the rates of motion, because when the bodies are farther out, they move slower over the stellar background, and some surveys may miss them. So it's not clear. But if everybody were as efficient as Mike Brown is, to about 20 objects should have been discovered here already, and only two have been. So this also argues for a population which is 10 times smaller than what Mike Brown, with a back-on-the-envelope calculation, estimates, so which leads from fiber of masses to 0.5 of masses, and all the problems go away. You do them from Neptune lane within an average cluster and there are no problems. Okay. So now we come to the question, to be or not to be a planet.
You know, there is this other argument that if aluminum 26 came into the solar system,
then
there got to be a more massive star out there. Okay, with that kind of stellar density in that kind of cluster, you know, I mean, in the Orion nebulas, barely we have a massive star that can produce supernova. But if you want to go to, say, the Taurus region, I'm not sure that you can produce a supernova, you know, give you the radioactive material.
Well, you know, first, it's not clear that all radioactive material comes from supernova. Iron 60, definitely, but you have millions of years. And aluminum is not clear. Maybe it's done by spallation.
And if you
really have both theories.
I think it's hard, but it's okay.
If you look at people like Kalmbach and John Bailey's work on looking at the protoplanets in Orion, they would argue that you can't build a solar system like ours. Because in an environment like that, because the water goes away.
Well, no, I mean, that's really in the outer part of the solar system. The inner part is preserved. Okay, I mean, you're talking about beyond 100 AU. But the inner part is not really that preserved.
Yeah.
You have to worry about a supernova in addition to the dynamical constraints from another meteorite constraint, and that is the plutonium 244 to uranium.
Well, I just want to raise a little.
But there is a paper by.
Not too big. Star is a better model.
But even then, you know, I don't know whether you a cluster of that kind.
Well, there is a paper by Adams and Laughlin, yes, who's starting from chemical constraints and the fact that stars had to blast and so on. They did use a cluster, which is of this order of magnitude, I think, of 3-4 times higher. Okay. Now the question that everybody was waiting for. To be or not to be a planet. So, as I said, this is not a scientific question, it's a semantic issue. So, everybody is right in this discussion, which is, we can do a poll and take a vote. So, I will tell you what I think, and then everybody can say what they think. So, I think that, well, Saturn is not a planet, but Pluto is not a planet either. So, my definition of a planet, we have to draw a line, an arbitrary line. Okay, I have three definitions for planets, which at least good for our solar system. First, that a planet must be more massive than the most massive moon. And why not? It's a criterion. It makes no sense to have satellites bigger than planets.
So how many planets do you think there are?
Eight. Yes, Mercury is 2 times bigger than the most massive moon in the solar system.
Some people size
mass.
You know that some people have ankles who are younger than them.
Yes, there are more things. Okay, so believe it or not, Mercury is twice more massive than the most massive moons in the solar system. Pluto is a fifth of the mass of the moon. Okay. Then, the planets have cleared their region in our solar system. So you don't find bodies, small bodies in the solar system, which are on stable orbits and that cross the orbits of the planet, unless they are shepherded like the Trojans of Jupiter. Okay. That's because the planets are massive enough, and when a body comes, they scatter it, and scattering over. Well, I mean, they are in the resonance, so they don't encounter the planet. It's like shepherding. Huh?
If Neptune had formed around a massive star that only lasted for 10 million years and hadn't cleaned out its orbit, it would never have been a planet?
I'm saying for our solar system, we want to judge if Pluto in our solar system is a planet or not, not if Pluto in another solar system would be a planet. So,
you mean that the Earth was not a planet until about 10 to the 9
years
later?
Yes, yes. I mean, if you can have a population of bodies which encounter your orbit and you're not able to get rid of them to clear your feeding zone, are not really a planet. You're not a boss.
Yes, but if we wait for 10 to 12 years, all those guys are going to have encounters with
them. I'm saying in our solar system. We have to judge which bodies are planets in our solar system.
How long are you prepared to wait?
Stellar lifetime.
Yeah.
Well.
Yeah.
and, you know.
I mean, planets are the boss of the solar system. Okay. When a boss enters into a room, everybody is respectful. And, okay. So you want that for a body to be a planet, you want that the small bodies are afraid of him.
Yes, but
okay. So if the small bodies don't care, they just say, hey, bye Pluto and go. And I mean, it's not the boss, right?
How do you explain that out? It's my boss.
But this is all very arbitrary because one of your
issue.
One of your encounters,
yeah.
One of your intruders from the outside can shake up everybody and then they will cross orbit. So they overnight they change from being a planet to not being a planet. Is that what you
You take a planet in a swarm of bodies in its surrounding region.
Yes,
and does it eliminate them or not?
No,
this is a quite easy question to answer.
Well,
come on.
So
all the planets have cleared their regions, okay, either by eliminating the bodies or shepherding them. Of course, we have stuff like NEAs or comets, but these are bodies on unstable regions, unstable orbits in 2 million years again, or even less, okay. But Pluto sits on an orbit which is shared by hundreds of thousands of other bodies, and they don't care. I mean, they just fly, bye Pluto, and they go. It's the effect, it's so weak that you don't see any really perturbation, for instance, in the orbital distribution of the Plutinos or the other Kuiper Belt objects due to Pluto. So that's also another criterion. Third criterion for our solar system, and I repeat our, all the other 8 planets sit on orbits which are fairly circular and on the same plane. And Pluto is a weird orbit, is in a resonance, high eccentricity, high inclination, and Mercury is nothing compared to Pluto. And it even crossed the orbit of Neptune. Fourth arguments. All the planets are named after gods, and Pluto is named after a dog. So.
No! Pluto is the god of the underworld!
That's your best argument.
So not only Pluto doesn't affect the other bodies, but it's not even detached from the size distribution. Right? You take the surrounding bodies of Pluto, and you have a continue, you plot the size distribution, it's a continuous size distribution. Pluto does not detach from the size distribution of the surrounding objects.
No, why?
And if there are 100 Sednas, there are 10 Plutos with the current size distribution.
No, why Pluto was okay? The, because it was a K9th planet.
Okay, so, but why, the question now is, why did astronomers call Pluto a planet for decades? So, and it's nice, and why we finish with that, to make the parallel with the asteroids, okay? Astronomers were looking for a planet in the asteroid belt, and they finally got one. In 1801, they discovered Ceres. And they said, wow, that's the planet. That's the planet that was missing according to the Titius Bode law. But what happened is that, well, first they immediately realized it was small, because it's small, and it's 1,000 kilometers in diameter. And second, in 1802, so 1 year later, Pallas was discovered, the second asteroid. And the orbit of Pallas crosses the orbit of Ceres. So astronomers said, uh-oh, these don't look like planets. And they gave another name, which we have forgotten about, which is very correct. It is small planets. Okay. Now they are called asteroids, but at the time they were called small planets.
Minor planets.
And what happened for Pluto? Pluto was discovered in 1930. It's very bright because of its albedo. So all estimates of its mass were wrong. Up to 1955, the estimates of the mass of Pluto that you can find in the literature range from 0.7 to 0.9 Earth masses. So it was a real planet.
So what was the value of the Hubble constant then?
It's only when Charon, the satellite, was discovered in 1978 that the mass could have been determined and went down from 0.8 Earth masses to 0.002 Earth masses, a fifth of the mass on the moon. But it was a little bit too late, no, to say, oh, okay, it's not a planet. It was 78 with respect to 1930, so it was 48 years late. And still, no other body was discovered in the same region. It was a standalone. It's not like Pallas coming 1 year after Ceres. It's only 1992 that the first Kuiper Belt object is discovered. So 62 years later, the discovery of Pluto. So these two facts, the fact of discovering Pluto and nothing else, so made astronomers think that Pluto is much bigger than anything else. And this error in the calculation of the early mass of Pluto led astronomers to believe that it was a planet. And then it went into the books, in the encyclopedia, and now we don't want to change. But I'm sure that if Pluto were discovered by Mike Brown today, no one would dream of calling it a planet. So that's my opinion. Now, it's up to you.
Well, Brian Marsden, who was one of the early ones to suggest that Pluto should not be a planet, consulted Clyde Tombaugh, the guy who discovered Pluto, and Tombaugh agreed.
He agreed. Wow.
He agreed. Oh, that's okay.
But he's been dead for years.
Made it easier.
It was during a spiritual sitting.
No, but like Scott Tremain said, that he once had a plaintive call from Tombaugh, who said, "You're not really going to demote Pluto, are you?"
Well, that must have been earlier.
Plaintive call.
Who made your black eye? It was over a discussion on Pluto.
No.
Yes.
What is the mass distribution of Kuiper Belt objects?
For the moment, it's very steep. It is the differential mass distribution, no, size distribution, because then I get it wrong, is proportional to r to the power minus 4. So that means that cumulatively, it's so the number of bodies bigger than r decreases as 1 over r power 3. Okay, so between Sedna and Pluto, there is a factor 2 in size. So power 3 is a factor of 8. So if Sedna is really 100 Sednas because it's just seen in 1% of its orbit, there are 10 Plutos out there. So how many planets does our solar system have?
A lot. And what's
the albedo distribution?
Sorry?
What's known about the albedo distribution?
Nothing. This is a big problem. It seems to be, in the past, people were saying, okay, the albedo must be very low, about 4%, because this is the albedo of the cometary nuclei when they are not active. And we believe that comets, long period comets come from here. So, okay, we know these objects have 4% albedo. And in fact, it was checked on some intermediate objects like the Centaurus and maybe even a few Kuiper Belt objects. But when it comes to the big objects, they have a much brighter albedo. Pluto has an albedo of 30%, and it's due to the fact that it has a frozen nitrogen atmosphere. So it has a very high electroactivity power. This object, Sedna, apparently has a comparable albedo, because otherwise, if it were big and dark, infrared observations would have spotted it. So it also has a big, bright albedo. And other objects, like Quaoar or Ixion, have albedos of the order of 10-15%. So it really seems to be something size-dependent, and we don't understand really well why.
So the big objects are actually brighter.
The big objects are much brighter than their size would. So you see a gap in the apparent magnitude distribution between the big objects and the small objects. But in fact, this gap is due to the fact that the big objects have a much higher albedo.
But the moon is quite dark.
The moon is quite dark. Yeah.
I think it's like 5%.
Yeah. The moon is dark, but the Earth is not.
Yeah, it's a
cloud.
No, it's actually about your shirt.
That's right,
about
the shirt.
But now Pluto, part of the reason it can be so bright, at least I thought the theory was that the atmosphere refroze at perihelion.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was fresh ice rather than old ice. But something like this.
Refroze was, there were gases coming out at perihelion. And so it could leave surface.
Yeah, exactly. What we'll say.
You are bombarded by cosmic rays, and the ice layers, they get distorted.
Right.
And that's why they become dark.
Right, but the outer ones.
The surface.
Yeah, Sedna is amazing. Yeah.
If it's right.
Yes. But, I mean, yeah, you are right. No one understands.
It's not measured yet to be as.
No, but it's a lower limit.
The mechanism
according to Mike Brown,
no,
you're right. I mean, it's a big mystery. I was talking to Mike Brown before coming here, and he was saying, I really don't understand, because I was not expecting a body so far to have such a bright albedo, and no one really understands why. Now, I mean, I repeat, all this is based on a non-detection in the infrared. So have they been unlucky in their infrared observations? I don't know how many times they tried to see it in the infrared, but it did not succeed. So I need the lower bounds.
I object to his
always
of planet, just on principle.
Yeah, because it's mine.
so to give you a little background about what I'm going to say, the guy who runs my office is the PI of the Pluto mission. Okay. So my office, at the time we were having these discussions, had a $400 billion grant proposal in order to go to Pluto. Okay. And their main scientific driver was it's the only planet we haven't been to. this person that I sort of work for had a vested interest in keeping Pluto as a planet. Well, I sort of took the position of mortal, right, that it's a little dinky thing, and who cares, right? So, but we came up with a compromise, which has been published in a couple places, so I thought I would tell you what our compromise was. His position on what is a planet is that if it's large enough that in the core center of the planet, gravity is more important than the physical strength of the stuff that the planet is made out of. In other words, you sort of have a sphere, then it's a planet.
We have thousands of them.
And there are thousands, well, I wouldn't say thousands, but there's probably 20 known planets. Okay, yeah, a lot more missions. and I actually find that a reasonable physical definition of what a good planet makes. And then we decided to divide planethood into two groups. Okay, originally we would have called them major or minor planets, but he felt minor was pejorative. So we decided on Uber and Unter. So there are, in our definition, 8 Uber planets, and we actually use Morby's definition of being able to clear out the small junk around them in order to define an Uber planet. And there's disadvantages to that definition, because it really is determined by your neighborhood, right, as to whether you're a planet or not. You put Jupiter out at 1,000 AU, and it's not going to clear the junk around it. So it's, you know, so it's really a function of environment, but that's okay, because planethood probably should be, in some level, a function of your neighborhood. So anything that was big enough to do that, which are the 8 major Uber planets, are Uber planets, and then everything else is just the drains. Okay, and so that's, Pluto would be an underplanet by this definition. Now I have my own definition.
And Sedna is two.
Sedna two. I have my own definition of planethood that I think I should share for you with you before we end, and that is, I think there are 2 planets in the solar system. Okay, because Jupiter and Saturn are stars, so we can just forget about them. everything inside the asteroid belt are just asteroids. And the Kuiper belt is just too small, so Uranus and Neptune are the only planets in the solar system. Thank you very much.